Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're unpacking a cultural artifact that, honestly, on paper, it really shouldn't have worked.
No, not at all.
We're talking about a piece of theater that tried to mix, ballet with knife fights,
Right.
operatic arias with street slang, and deep social commentary with a love story.
It's a massive collision of styles.
Yeah, exactly. We are talking about West Side Story, but we aren't just looking at the movie you probably watched in high school music class.
Oh, definitely not.
We're looking at the collision of four massive egos that created it. And based on the historical records and Wikipedia archives we've pulled for this deep dive, we're going to see how close this masterpiece actually came to being a complete disaster.
It really is a miracle of collaboration. And mostly because the collaborators, we're talking Leonard Bernstein, Jerome Robbins, Arthur Lawrence, and a very, very young Stephen Sondheim, they were constantly at odds.
Just constantly fighting.
Yeah, they were trying to invent a new kind of lyric theater, they called it. And the sources we're looking at today paint a picture of a production that was just constantly teetering on the edge of failure.
And it's fascinating because when you look at the history, the show we know almost didn't even exist.
Right.
Like the original concept wasn't about the Jets and the Sharks at all.
Not even close.
In fact, if things had gone to plan back in 1949, we'd be sitting here talking about a musical called East Side Story.
Which just sounds like a bad parody, doesn't
It
it?
really does. East Side Story.
But that was the working title. Jerome Robbins pitched this modern Romeo and Juliet to Bernstein and Lawrence. But the conflict, it wasn't racial or territorial in the way we think of it now.
Right.
It was religious. It was set on the Lower East Side of New York during the confluence of Easter and Passover.
Okay, looking at the notes here, the conflict was between a Catholic family and a Jewish family.
Exactly.
And the Maria character, she wasn't Puerto Rican. She was a Holocaust survivor who had emigrated from Israel.
Right. And the Tony character was a Catholic boy from the neighborhood.
Wow.
Yeah, it was incredibly heavy subject matter for the musical theater landscape of the late 40s. You have to remember, this is the era of South Pacific.
Right. Kiss me, Kate.
Exactly. The idea of putting anti-Semitism and the fresh shadow of the Holocaust center stage in a Broadway musical, it was radical.
Super radical.
But ironically, the reason they killed the project wasn't because it was too radical. It
Oh.
was because it felt too familiar to them.
That seems really counterintuitive. How is a Holocaust survivor romance familiar?
Well, once Lawrence actually wrote the draft, they stepped back and realized they were essentially just rewriting AB's Irish Rose.
Oh, right, the old play.
Yeah, that was a play from the 1920s about an Irish Catholic girl and a Jewish boy. It was a massive hit back then, but by 1949, it was a total cliche.
Just felt dated.
Right, it felt like a period piece. It lacked urgency. They realized that religious conflict in New York, while still very real, it just didn't have the violent, explosive immediacy they needed for a tragedy.
It didn't have that edge.
Exactly. So they shelved it.
Just put it in a drawer.
Yep, put it away.
And it stayed on that shelf for a long time. It wasn't until, what, 1955 that the spark reignited?
Right, 1955.
And this is where the timeline really matters for you, the listener. You're looking at the mid-50s, which was the absolute height of the media panic over juvenile delinquency.
Oh, it was everywhere in the news.
The headlines were practically writing the script for them.
They really were. Bernstein and Lawrence were at the Beverly Hills Hotel, just sitting by the pool discussing the morning papers.
As you do.
Right. And the news was obsessed with gang warfare. But specifically, out in Los Angeles, there were violent turf wars breaking out between Chicano gangs and white gangs.
Okay.
Bernstein, being the musician, he immediately saw the potential. He suggested they just set the musical in LA and call it a day.
Which, I mean, that would have been a totally different energy.
Entirely different.
A sun-drenched
Yeah.
LA noir version of West Side Story.
It would have been fascinating.
Yeah.
But Arthur Laurents put his foot down.
He wasn't having it.
No, he was a New Yorker through and through.
Right.
He basically said, "Look, Lenny, I don't know the Mexican-American experience in California. I can't write that authentically.
Right.
But I know New York. I know the Puerto Rican migration that's happening right now in the city."
And that pivot, that is the key.
It changed everything.
By shifting it to the Upper West Side, which gives us the West in West Side Story, and making it about the Sharks, who are the Puerto Rican migrants, versus the Jets.
Who were the white working class kids?
Right, arguably Polish or Irish descent.
Yeah.
By doing that, they tapped into something much more volatile than just religious difference. They
Absolutely.
tapped into xenophobia, displacement, and just the terrifying concept of the other.
it grounded that whole Shakespearean structure in a very specific socioeconomic reality.
Right, because not just two households both alike in dignity anymore.
No, this was a turf war over crumbling concrete. The Jets are fighting because they're poor and they're feeling replaced in their own neighborhoods. The Sharks are fighting because they're being marginalized and actively attacked.
It raised the stakes entirely.
It took it from, my dad hates your dad to my very existence threatens your existence.
Man, that is heavy.
It is.
So the concept is locked in, but now they have to actually write the thing.
Always the hard part.
Right. And this brings us to the Dream Team dynamics. You've got Bernstein doing the music,
Yep.
Laurent's writing the book, the script,
Right.
Robin's directing and
The
choreographing.
powerhouse trio.
But they needed a lyricist.
Yeah.
And this is where a 25-year-old Stephen Sondheim just walks into the room.
The irony here is that Sondheim didn't even want the gig.
Really?
Yeah, he was a composer.
Hmm?
He looked at lyric writing as almost a secondary skill, like a limitation.
He wanted to do it all?
He wanted to write the music and the words. But his mentor was Oscar Hammerstein II.
Oh, wow. Of Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Exactly, the absolute kings of Broadway. And Hammerstein gave him some serious career-defining advice. He told him, take the job, because it will teach you how to structure a musical.
Wow. And it certainly did.
It was the best advice he could have gotten.
But there's a fascinating bit of history regarding the credits on this.
Well, the billing controversy.
Yeah, originally the billing was supposed to be, quote, lyrics by Leonard Bernstein and Stephen Sondheim.
Right, because Bernstein was doing a lot of the lyric work early on.
But then just before the show opened, Bernstein actually pulled his name off the lyricist's credit entirely.
He did. It was a moment of incredible professional generosity.
Really rare in that business.
Very rare. Bernstein saw that the best lyrics in the show, the wit of G, Officer Kripke, the rhythmic drive of America, that was really Sondheim's work.
Yeah.
So by giving Sondheim sole credit, he basically handed him a career on a silver platter.
Just launched him.
Yep. Although, I mean, if you dig into the gossip of the time, there's a slightly more cynical theory about that too.
Oh, do tell. I love the historical gossip.
Well, at the exact same time West Side Story was being written, Bernstein was also composing Candide.
Okay.
And there were rumors that Sondheim had actually done a significant amount of uncredited work on the lyrics for Candide just to help Bernstein out when he was overwhelmed.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah, some historians speculate that the sole credit on West Side Story was actually a payment.
Like a trade-off.
Exactly, a trade-off for the ghostwriting he did on Candide.
Well, that makes it sound a little more
A
transactional.
little bit, yeah.
But either way, it established Sondheim as an absolute force in the theater.
Without a doubt.
But even with this superhero team assembled, getting the show produced was a complete nightmare.
Oh, it was brutal. The producers hated
They
it.
were terrified of it, weren't they?
You have to contextualize this for a second. In 1957, a hit musical was The Music Man
Right.
or My Fair Lady. You went to the theater to escape.
To feel good.
Exactly. And here comes West Side Story. It opens with a gang fight and it ends with a corpse.
Act one ends with two bodies on stage.
Right. Sheryl Crawford, who was a legendary producer originally attached to it, she actually quit the project just 2 months before rehearsal started.
2 months. That's a huge blow.
Massive. She said the book was brilliant, but the show was, quote, too dark, and the music was, quote, too difficult.
Too difficult is an understatement. I mean, Bernstein was writing music that required legitimate operatic range.
Real vocal chops.
But then Robbins demanded dancers who could, like, do backflips off fire escapes.
Right at the same time.
The casting call must have been absolutely impossible. They needed triple threats before that term was even a standard thing in the industry.
They really did. And they needed young people, too.
Yeah, that was a big sticking point.
Bernstein was adamant that they couldn't have 30-year-olds playing teenagers.
Like they usually did in movies back then.
Exactly. So they cast virtually unknown actors.
And once they had them, Jerome Robbins didn't exactly treat them with kid gloves.
Oh, he was notoriously tough.
He implemented what we might call method direction today.
Right.
But at the time, the cast probably just saw it as psychological warfare.
It basically was. I mean, this is the stuff of Broadway legend.
He segregated the cast, right?
Rigorously. He forbade the actors playing the Jets and the actors playing the Sharks from socializing at all.
You're kidding.
No, they couldn't eat lunch together. They couldn't speak to each other during downtime.
Wow.
If he caught them being friendly in the hallway, he'd berate them. He wanted genuine animosity.
It sounds cruel, honestly.
It does.
But looking at the Rumble scene or the prologue, I mean, you can't argue with the results.
The tension is palpable.
There is a tension in their body language that feels legitimately dangerous. It doesn't look like actors pretending to hate each other.
No, it looks like tribal warfare.
He even posted newspaper clippings of actual gang murders on the backstage bulletin board.
He did. He wanted to constantly remind them, you know, this isn't a game. People are actually dying over this out in the streets. It traumatized some of the cast, frankly, but it created this electric atmosphere that Broadway had just never seen before.
Let's get into the material itself a bit, because the music does so much of the heavy lifting in telling that story.
It's the engine of the whole show.
Bernstein's score is incredibly complex. He's blending jazz, Latin rhythms, and these huge symphonic suites.
Yeah, with a massive pit orchestra, they had five percussionists down there.
Five. That's insane for a Broadway pit.
Unheard of at the time.
But there's one specific musical device, an interval, that really ties the whole show together.
Yes, the famous tritone.
Can you break that down for us?
Sure. It's an interval of an augmented fourth. So if you sing the first two notes of Maria Mari, that jump right there.
Right, that unsettled sound.
Exactly. That unsettled, unresolved jump is a tritone. In classical music theory, going back centuries, it was known as diabolus in musica.
The devil in music.
The devil in music. It was considered the most dissonant, unstable interval possible. Monks weren't allowed to sing it in the Middle Ages.
Which is such a brilliant choice for a love song in a tragedy.
It is.
Because it tells your ear subconsciously that this isn't going to end well.
Precisely. It yearns for a resolution that it just doesn't get.
Yeah.
And Bernstein doesn't just use it in Maria. That tritone is everywhere in the show.
It's basically the DNA of the score.
It's in the cool fugue. It's the opening whistle of the show, those first three notes.
Oh, you're right.
It's in the rumble music. The entire score is basically infected with this instability. It subtly keeps the audience on edge for 2.5 hours.
That is genius.
Isn't it?
And then you have the rhythm. I remember reading about the time signature in America.
Oh, yeah.
It's not a standard 4/4 pop beat at all.
No, and this is where Bernstein's genius really shines through. He uses a mixed meter called a hemiola.
The hemiola.
Yeah, which is very common in Latin American music, specifically the huapango.
Okay, how does that work?
It alternates between 6/8 and 3/4 times. So you count it like 1/2/3/4/5/6, 1/2/3/4.
Right.
It creates that driving off-kilter pulse. It's infectious, but it's also really complex.
And it fits the scene so perfectly.
It captures the energy of the argument between Anita and Rosalia. It's literally a rhythmic debate about the immigrant experience.
Sondheim's precision there is just amazing.
Turning these huge, complex ideas into these tight, witty lyrics.
Speaking of the words, the dialogue had to walk a very fine line, too.
Arthur Lorentz had a really tough job with the book.
Because he was terrified that using actual 1957 street slang would make the show sound dated within, like, a few years.
Exactly. Slang changes so fast.
Like, cool and hip might stick around, but other words just disappear. So he just invented a language.
He really did. He created this stylized street talk, phrases like cut the frabajaba or cracko jocko.
Frabba-jabba is my personal
That's
favorite.
so weird.
It sounds like complete nonsense, but in the context of the scene, it sounds like a legitimate insult.
And it works because it captures the cadence of slang without being tied to a specific calendar year.
That's the trick.
It allows the show to feel gritty, whether you're watching it in 1957 or 1980 or 2020.
Because if they had used actual 50s slang.
Oh, the sharks would have sounded like beatnik caricatures within a decade. It would have been laughable.
Now, the story itself also deviates from Shakespeare in some pretty profound
It
ways.
takes the Romeo and Juliet skeleton, but makes some very pointed changes.
Right. In Romeo and Juliet, both lovers die. It's a
Yeah.
double suicide. But in West Side Story, Maria lives.
Huh?
There's no suicide plot point at all.
And in many ways, that feels like a much crueler ending.
It does. It forces the survivor to bear the witness.
Exactly. If Maria dies, the tragedy is sealed. It's over. But by keeping her alive, the audience has to sit with her grief and her
She
rage.
has to live with the consequences of everyone else's hate.
But the biggest structural change from Shakespeare, and the one that I think makes West Side Story truly an American tragedy, is the complete absence of parents.
Right.
In Shakespeare, the Montagues and Capulets are on stage. They're part of the problem, obviously, but they are present.
They exist in the world.
But in West Side Story, the parents are completely invisible.
They're mentioned usually with disdain or as a joke, but we never actually see them.
Never.
The only adults in the whole show are Doc, the police, and the social worker at the dance.
Gladhan.
Yeah.
And those adults are portrayed as either helpless, like Doc.
Just kind of watching it happen.
Or actively hostile and racist, like Lieutenant Schrank.
Hmm.
This emphasizes that the tragedy is really a result of abandonment.
That's a great point.
These kids have created their own society, the gangs, because actual society and their own families have failed them. They are basically orphans of a living city.
That theme of abandonment really resonates. And I think that brings us to how the show keeps coming back.
The revival.
Yeah, we've had major revivals, and each one tries to interrogate the text differently based on the era.
Starting with the original 1957 run.
Right, which opened to positive reviews, but it actually lost the Best Musical Tony.
To the Music Man.
Which is wild in hindsight.
Although Robbins did win for choreography.
Naturally. But then the 1961 film happens.
And that's the juggernaut.
Massive success. 10 Academy Awards, including Best Picture.
And Rita Moreno winning Best Supporting Actress for playing Anita.
The first Latina to ever do so.
A huge milestone. They also tweaked the structure a bit for the film.
They swapped some songs around, didn't they?
Yeah, they swapped the order of Cool and G, Officer Kripke.
Right.
And they moved I Feel Pretty to Before the Rumble, which makes a lot more sense dramatically.
It definitely heightens the tragic irony.
Absolutely.
But then let's jump to the 2009 revival.
Directed by Arthur Laurence himself.
Who was in his 90s at the time.
Mind-blowing that he came back to direct it.
And he tried to fix the language issue.
Right.
He felt that having Puerto Rican characters speak exclusively in English to each other just wasn't authentic.
Right. So he hired Lin-Manuel Miranda.
This is pre-Hamilton, by the way.
Yes, young Lin-Manuel. Laurence hired him to translate significant portions of the lyrics and dialogue into Spanish.
A completely bilingual Broadway production.
On paper, it sounds like a fantastic update for realism.
It really does.
It was a very bold experiment. Songs like I Feel Pretty became Me Siento Hermosa.
But they ran into a practical problem, according to the sources.
They did. Musical theater relies heavily on lyrics to advance the plot. It's not just a pop song.
Right. The words give you the story.
So when the Sharks sang A Boy Like That in Spanish, non-Spanish-speaking audiences completely missed the nuance of the argument between Anita and Maria.
The narrative momentum just stalled for them.
Exactly. So midway through the run, they actually switched some of the songs back to English.
Just to save the storytelling.
But they kept the Spanish in the Tonight Quintet.
Which is brilliant.
I think it worked beautifully there because that song is much more about the overlapping emotion than actual plot exposition.
That makes total sense. Then we fast forward to the 2020 revival.
Directed by Ivo Van Hove.
And if Laurence wanted realism in 2009, Van Hove wanted, well, something else entirely in 2020.
A radical departure.
This was the production that got rid of the iconic finger snaps.
Which was sacrilege to some people. People were furious.
They really were. But Van Hove wanted to strip away all the nostalgia.
He felt that West Side Story had become too cozy.
Too much of a classic.
Right. It had lost its edge. So he made huge changes. He cut I Feel Pretty entirely.
Wow.
He removed the intermission. He replaced the classic choreography with hip-hop and Latin influences.
And the set design was crazy, right?
He used massive video screens that just dwarfed the actors on stage. The cast actually carried iPhones and filmed themselves live.
I remember seeing clips of that. It felt like he was trying to say to the audience, you know, this isn't history, this is right now.
Exactly. Just as Jerome Robbins used newspapers to ground his cast in 1957 reality, Van Hove used iPhones to ground his 2020 cast.
That's a great parallel.
He was trying to show that the surveillance, the violence, the immediacy, it's still exactly the same.
Though the sources say it was highly polarizing.
Very polarizing. Some critics felt it was too cold, almost too much like a video art installation. But it did prove that the core text is strong enough to withstand that kind of radical reinterpretation.
And then, of course, the 2021 film directed by Spielberg.
Which felt much more like a love letter to the original.
Well, also correcting some of its historical sins.
Mainly regarding representation and the brown face used in the 1961 film.
Spielberg and screenwriter Tony Kushner did a lot of work to give the Sharks more agency, more of a backstory.
They gave it a very gritty historical look.
And bringing Rita Moreno back to play a new character, Valentina replacing the Doc character.
That was a stroke of genius.
It really provided a bridge between the generations.
It was beautiful.
It's just amazing to think about the journey from that rejected East Side Story script to the absolute cultural juggernaut it is today.
The evolution is incredible.
But when you strip away the Oscars, you know, the revivals, the choreography, what is the core message that makes you, the listener, keep watching it?
For me, based on everything we've looked at, I think it's the way it forces us to look at the true cost of hate. There is a line in G, Officer Kripke, where the Jet says, "No one wants a fellow with a social disease."
Which is played for laughs in the song.
It's totally a joke in the moment, but the show is actually arguing that hatred is the social disease.
It's systemic.
It infects everything.
And the ending really just hammers that home.
That final scene.
Maria picks up the gun. She doesn't fire it. Yeah. But she holds everybody at gunpoint.
And that is the moment of true tragedy in the show. Not Tony's death, as sad as that is.
Right.
It's Maria's corruption. When she screams, "Now I can kill too, because now I have hate."
It gives you chills.
We realize that the innocent girl from the beginning of the show has been completely destroyed. The violence of the world has finally infected her.
It is such a bleak ending for a musical.
It really is.
The gangs eventually come together to carry Tony's body out, which suggests some kind of reconciliation, but at what cost?
That's the lingering question, and I want to leave the listener with this final thought, something to really chew on. In Shakespeare's ending, after Romeo and Juliet die, the parents, Capulet and Montague, they arrive on scene.
Right, they see what happened.
They see the bodies, they realize what their feud has caused, and they agree to build statues of their children.
The older generation actually takes responsibility.
Exactly, they end the feud. There's a resolution from the top down.
But in West Side Story.
In West Side Story, the parents never show up.
Never.
The stage clears, the kids carry the body away, and the adults are still completely absent.
Wow.
So we have to ask ourselves when we watch it, is the tragedy of West Side Story just about gang violence? Or is it an indictment of a society that watches its children destroy themselves and just refuses to intervene until it's far too late?
That is a haunting thought. Is failure of the youth just a reflection of the absence of the generation before them?
It's a heavy question.
It really is. West Side Story might be catchy, it might have great dancing, but man, does it leave a mark.
It definitely does.
Well, thank you for diving in with us today.
Always a pleasure.
We will see you on the next one.